Dietschewitz, whose academic career has taken him from Imperial College London to University College London. And he's going to tell us about quantum clocks.
Hi. Yep. So this is joint work with Ralf Silva, who's in Switzerland, Michael Holdesky in Poland, and Jonathan Oppenheim, who's at UCL with me. The topic is quantum clocks. So what do I mean by this? So often in quantum mechanics, you'll be under a situation where you want to apply a unitary to a particular quantum system. Okay, maybe it's had its own local Hamiltonian dynamics, and at some point in time, you'll apply unitary. So often this is treated like with a semi-classical approach. For example, I mean, if it's a laser, it's a have a classical approximation for the laser, and generally the Hamiltonian is time dependent essentially of your quantum system, because there will be at some point where the laser will be turned on and off, and this will make the Hamiltonian time dependent. So what we're interested in here is addressing the scenario where we have an ancilla system, an ancilla quantum system, such that the system plus ancilla system form a closed unitary dynamics with a time-independent Hamiltonian. And then we ask the question, well, how well can one build this ancilla system, which we call a clock for reasons will come apparent during the talk, how well can we construct this so that it will, as far as the system of interest is concerned, its dynamics will be just its local Hamiltonian. At some point in time, the ancilla system will apply unitary on it, and then after that moment in time, it will just evolve according to its local dynamics again. Okay, so as we'll see in the talk, one cannot do this perfectly, or at least the only way to do it perfectly is to cheat in some way, which we'll see. So then, of course, the big question is, so if you can't do it perfectly with a finite dimensional system, how well can you do it? And then the question is, well, so how do these errors scale? How do they depend on dimension, et cetera, et cetera? And that's what we address. People studied these kind of clocks, but from a very qualitative point of view. And here we have a very quantitative statement about the accuracy of these clocks. Okay, so that brief introduction will say the overview. So the outline of the talk is like this. We'll first off address some of the clocks in the literature and point out finite dimensional ones versus infinite dimensional ones, talk about their properties. The fast part will have to be a bit funny, but we'll get a serious message across. And then we'll go into the second part, which, my finger's over the thing. Okay, then we'll go into the second part where we'll talk about our actual result, and it'll be a bit more formal, and then we'll have applications and a conclusion. Okay, Peres clock. So, okay, formally, I don't think other people have called them this in the literature, it's just what I call them, because to my knowledge, he's the first person who kind of came up with this clock idea, or at least introduced it formally in the sense of a paper in 1979. And it will be the kind of clock we will be interested in for our results. So basically how this works is the clock Hamiltonian of the ancilla system is given by this. So you can think of it like a truncated harmonic oscillator. So the levels are equally spaced and we have some frequency omega. For this clock, we can define a new basis here, which we call the angle basis, which is related to the energy eigenbasis by a discrete Fourier transform. Okay, and this basis has a very, very nice property. Okay, so namely that if we start off, to illustrate the point, we choose d equals 12. So we have 12 angle states, and if we start off with the initial state of the clock in a particular angle state, and we let it time evolve under the Hamiltonian for a time 2 pi over omega 1 over d, we find that it exactly evolved to the next angle state, okay? And then if we evolve it further for another multiple of this amount of time, we'll find we've gone exactly again to the next angle state. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way, in this case, all the way to 12 o'clock, and then we'll start again. So it's periodic, okay? We'll just go round and round and round. And the nice thing about this is that, so essentially, in some way, it behaves like a natural classical clock, in the sense that the amount of time it takes to go from one angle state to the next angle state is a constant. Okay, and this is what you like about clocks, right? So a normal clock on the wall, so you know the time between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock is the same amount of time between 8 and 7 o'clock, right? So this is nice. But it's not perfect, so in a sense that this is only true at these particular discrete values of time. So in between, the dynamics will be such that, that the actual state will be a superposition of all the other angle states, okay? But at least at these particular times, it has this nice property. Okay, and yeah, so we can use this clock as to make like an alarm clock, okay? So imagine you're Homer Simpson and you're asleep and you want to wake him up at a certain time. So we can use a Paris clock to wake him up, okay? So he has his alarm, he wants to wake up at 6 a.m. And he sets this at 12 o'clock. So the initial state of the clock will be 12 o'clock and Homer Simpson is the system we want to do something to at a particular time, namely 6 o'clock. His local Hamiltonian is just identical, he's sleeping, so he's not really doing much. But we want his system to be unperturbed by the clock, except for at 6 a.m. when suddenly the alarm clock will go off and he'll feel some effect due to the clock, due to this interaction term. So this won't happen perfectly, but to some approximation, what I just said under the local dynamics will be the case. Oops, sorry. But what happens at 12 o'clock, 6 a.m.? So he's only slept 6 hours, he wants to sleep more, so what happens when it rings, he hits the clock, but it breaks. So basically, what happens is that for these fine-dimensional clocks is that there's a back reaction on the system, on the clock, which damages the clock, okay? For this case, so in some sense, these what I call Paris clocks are kind of fragile, in that sense, okay? So how can we get around this issue? So, I mean, a clock is all very good on the wall, but it's not very good if the fact of looking at time or measuring time in some way distorts the clock, right? So this is a bad thing. So how can we get around this? Well, we can make the clock very big. So if its dimensionality of the Paris clock is very large, at 6 o'clock when it goes off and Homer wakes up, whenever he tries to hit it, he might put a little dent in the clock, but he's not going to completely, you know, destroy the clock. So our errors will be on bounding this error, okay? There's an alternative strategy to wake Homer up with a clock, and that is with the what is in a sense that the perfect clock, okay? This P clock. So in this clock, the Hamiltonian of the clock is now this a momentum operator, and the interaction term is with the position operator, okay? And we have some interaction term here. So here, time now is associated with x, with position in the x-axis, okay? So you could imagine associating 12 a.m. in the morning when Homer set the alarm clock to be, to this position in on the x-axis, and we'll associate there some wave function, which will be the initial state of the clock at time equals zero. And then the interaction term will have support only on a finite region of space, which we associate with 6 a.m. Okay, and we can see what happens with this clock. So, okay, here it's not obviously a gravitational field, but it's drawn like this, but it's some kind of field where we can imagine something falling. So what will happen is that after 6 a.m., so after it's gone through this position, Homer will wake up, and now the wave function of this thing will be down here. But we notice it has this nice property that at least the absolute value of the wave function is the same as the initial wave function, just translated spatially. So if you remember, this was t equals, so this parameterized time, and this is position, so here it's the same as the initial state, but just moved down a bit, okay? And we'll see this a bit more formally later on, but this is the basic idea. However, these Hamiltonians have a big problem with them. Namely, it's kind of like a bottomless pit. So what do I mean by that is that the Hamiltonian is unbounded from below. So this Hamiltonian is completely unphysical. You couldn't actually build this because in nature, you know, the potential has to be bounded from below, so you don't have bottomless pits, okay? So this is the big problem with this type of Hamiltonian. And we can look at this as well from the so-called time energy uncertainty relation, which is this statement here. which is like the variance of some operator divided by its time derivative in the Heisenberg picture. You take its expectation value, and its absolute value of that, multiplied by the variance in the Hamiltonian, this is, has to be less than or equal to half. So if you remember back earlier, I said one nice property of a clock you would like is that it sweeps through time at equal intervals, okay? So in other words, we would like the derivative of this guy here to be a constant. So if you impose the derivative of this to be a constant, then you get this relation here that these operators have to satisfy. Now, for our p-Hamiltonian, we see that this implies that t is just the position operator, okay? So this is kind of, so first off, it's interesting there actually exists a solution to these equations, okay? But you see that the solution does exist is the one of this perfect clock, which is unphysical because it's unbounded from below. So you can observe perfectly that the, if you associate this with a time axis, you can observe it perfectly. But again, so this observation actually goes all the way back to Heisenberg and Pauli, and it was they disputed this a lot, but they kind of come to the conclusion that this kind of implies that there's no time, there's no operator you can associate with time in quantum mechanics, because the only Hamiltonians we allow that are unbounded from below, so unphysical. Okay. Okay. So that concludes the first part of the talk. Now we're going to go into our particular result. And first off, I'll say the model a little bit more carefully, so the actual theorem makes some sense. So, okay, it turns out that if we want to apply this energy-preserving unit, U, to the system, then there exists a basis for which it's simultaneously diagonalizable with the Hamiltonian of the system, okay? Even if it's degenerate, it's still true. So. And in that basis, the unitary corresponds to applying phases, okay? So it turns out that we can associate with the unitary just a set of phases, okay? And then we can implement any unitary. So what happens in the ideal case? So the ideal case is that before a time t star, which is the time we associate with the time we want to apply the unitary, the system will just evolve according to its local dynamics, okay? And then after that time, at the time t star, we'll apply the unitary, and then it will just evolve according to this, you know, so its local dynamics with a unitary applied to it from then afterwards, okay? So that's the ideal case. Of course, as I said earlier, we want to do this from the perspective of a closed system and implement this via a clock, which is some ancilla system. So for that, our model will be of this form, so we'll choose I said this will just be these Peres clocks I said earlier of dimension d, and then some arbitrary system Hamiltonian, and then we'll have some interaction term. And we'll specialize the interaction term for our particular model to be of this form. So it encodes, so on the system part, we encode the operator, the unitary we want to implement, and then we have this potential, this object here we'll call the clock potential. Say, which we'll choose in such a way that we'll implement the unitary, okay? And then we'll have the initial state will be a product state where the state of the clock is a pure state. Okay, so if we define epsilon n to be this quantity here, so basically it's the evolution of the initial clock state under the clock Hamiltonian plus the potential on the clock, okay, with the phases. So evolve for one period of the clock, okay? And then we subtract the initial state, but we've just applied the phase of the clock. So it turns out that if you write the rho SE as the time evolution of the whole thing and partially trace out the clock, then in trace distance after one period of the clock, so from what the ideal case, you know, when the unit has been implemented to this case where we want to implement the unitary, the distance, the difference is very, very small. Well, at least if this quantity here is very small, and the theorem will state how small this quantity can be. Okay, so this is just the maximum of the two norm of this guy here. So we want this to be close. And it turns out as well that for the clock, as I said, we want the back reaction on the clock also to be very small. So we can measure that by saying, okay, let's look at the period of the clock if there was no interaction after one period, After one period, it just is returned to its initial state perfectly. So we can compare that with what the final state of the clock actually is returned to. And again, it's bounded by this epsilon quantity. Then this is our results. So first off, we specialize this, we write the interaction, the clock potential in this form here. So we define it to be diagonal in the angle basis, and we write these, we define this V quantity to be the clock potential. So to remind ourselves of the previous case, so in the case of waking Homer up, this potential here was essentially 0, 0, 0, except for where k equals 6 at 6 a.m., and then it was a peak, right? So we write it here in a slightly more general form, but the idea is that you would want this guy to be peaked around the time in which the unitary wants to be implemented, okay? And then the initial state of the clock, you write like this, where this, in general, for non-zero delta is written like this. I write it like this because we later use a slightly more general version, but the initial state of the clock, essentially, for delta is zero, this term here vanishes, and it's just a Gaussian in the clock basis centered at k naught. So if we go back to the analogy of waking Homer up, the initial state of the clock was 12 a.m. in the morning, and so here we'll choose, in the d-dimensional case, we'll choose k naught to be 12. Yeah, so we want it, it's not perfectly, but it's kind of centered around there, okay? And then for the result, we have to define an analytic extension to this this potential. So this potential here maps the real line to the reals, and it x is such, this has to be such that when x is equal to 2 pi divided by d times k, it is equal to this guy, okay? And additionally, it has to have some other property. So it has to be smooth, so all its derivatives have to be well defined, and it also has to be periodic with period d, and the integral over one period of this potential has to be equal to some angle, this angle here, okay? And it will turn out this is the angle we want to implement in the particular case, okay? So, and then our theorem basically states, so this is not all of it, okay, that's the next slide and you'll see the rest, but it basically is concerning the dynamics of this quantity, which, remember, this quantity, when we subtract, remember what we said before in the ideal case, that after one period, so when t equals capital T, this is just equal to the initial state times a phase, right? So in general, for general t, it's equal to this guy here, where this obviously is defined above, plus some error epsilon, okay? So the important part of the theorem basically is bounding this epsilon. That's the kind of key thing. So it turns out we can prove that this epsilon is the little constant, so it grows linearly in time, and decays exponentially in the clock dimension d. Okay, where this is basically the idea that as the clock becomes big, the error becomes very small. And so the rate of decay though depends on this b term, which is given down here. And this, basically speaking, encodes how good the potential is, right? Because we want the potential, like in the optimal case, to be like a Dirac delta function, but in reality, it's going to be something that's like highly peaked around the time at which we want to implement the unitary. So that's basically encoded. Obviously, if it's very peaked, though, there's a bigger error, and that's encoded here. So basically, this quantity here, we have a explicit expression for this, but I didn't want to go into full details for simplicity. But the important thing to take away is that it, for large d, it goes as log d. Okay, so actually, it gets small. And then this quantity here is the part that encodes the information about the potential or the analytic extension. And basically, this here is the k minus 1 derivative of this potential. And then we maximize it over one period, and then we take the supremum over 1 over k over all the derivatives. Okay. So this is going to be a finite number as long as this guy, basically speaking, goes as some constant, so the kth derivative goes as some constant to the power k, right? So it grows as like that, because then we'll get a finite number. Yes, okay. And now, as I said before, so an important thing here is that, well, by direct plugging in the numbers, you see that when t equals one period, this is precisely what we want. So it's precisely the initial state times times this guy here, okay? This is true because the modulo arithmetic of the states. That's just straightforward. Okay, one example, so yeah, I'll give an example. So here, example is the cosine potential. So imagine this guy is given by this here, where n is a positive integer, okay, which encodes, if you want, how steep this potential is, okay? So in the ideal case, you want this to be a very, very large number, so it's essentially zero and then and like one, okay, around the point where you implement. And it turns out you can calculate, well, upper bound this B quantity, and it goes like this. So it goes as n log n, so as we expected, as the potential gets steeper, so it's more you want, it means that the rate of, so it's always still going to be exponential decay, but a slower rate, okay? But then also this quantity here goes as log d, so so basically at beginning it will be exponential decay, but a slower rate, but then as log d gets large enough, this will essentially go to zero, and we're going to get the exponential k with this factor of pi over 4, okay? So like the best we can get according to the theorem. And yeah, so this is just a plot here for n equals 1, n equals 20. As you see, the potential gets steeper, and also 100 gets steeper and steeper. And then remember that in the middle here, so suppose we choose k naught to be 30, then the initial state is some Gaussian centered around that point. So this could be look something like this. So here you can see initially it's essentially not interacting with anything. There's no overlap. But as time goes on, it's going to move through the potential, and then it's going to interact. So this is where the unitary will start to happen. And then yeah, unitary will start happening, and then it'll come back to the initial state and won't be interaction. So I know, for example, you could imagine and also as d gets larger, this gets more and more peaked. By the way, we've constructed the Gaussian, so it's more and more peak but larger dimensions. So the way, so you could imagine, for example, you have a fully quantum unitary device that implements a unitary, and you could have the period to be, say, 24 hours, one day, and then you could have this potential, so now essentially nothing's happening, and then maybe, I know, 1 hour before the interaction starts happening, it starts to turn on, and it just turns off again, okay? So, and then for the rest of the day, you know, if it's a quantum computer, whatever, then you know your calculation would have been done by the end of the day, and you don't need your clock anymore. Okay, so after one period. Okay. Oh yeah. So now we're just going to show the analogy between our clock, or this Peres clock, and the perfect case. Okay, this case I drew before. So it was the case that Homer Simpson got woken up by the bucket of water case. Okay. So in that case, in our model, as I said, if you remember, the quantity of interest you want to calculate is the evolution for the clock, initial clock state under its own Hamiltonian plus the clock part of the potential, okay? So, and this guy, which is the momentum operator, so it's given by this, plus B of x, okay, the potential of the function of x. So on the back of envelope, you can actually solve the Schrödinger equation for the dynamics of this, and it turns out that this is the solution. So what's this telling us is that essentially, at t equals zero, we have this initial state, this vanishes, and then as t grows, we just take the position of this wave function, we just translate it in time, but we also then integrate over the potential from a region t all the way to x, okay? So here again, it's clear as well why we want this to be steep, right? So essentially nothing's going to happen, so if this potential is essentially zero, zero, and then something, essentially, this is going to be zero when we integrate first, and then at the time when the potential starts to, you know, do the unitary, then we're going to start to acquire this phase that's going to be equal to the area under the potential. Okay, and then afterwards, it's, nothing's going to happen again because you're integrating over zero. Yeah. Okay, so there's a direct analogy between this and our result, which is this. So if we take the overlap between the quantity of interest and the kth angle state, so remember, In our kind of model, time is measured by these angle states, right? So this is the kind of quantity of interest, whereas here, the quantity measured time, which is x, is the position. So if we look at this guy, our theorem says it's equal to this. Whereas this guy here, if we just plug in the definitions, up to epsilon, so basically just neglecting this quantity here, it's equal to this guy here. So what we see here is that, so we can identify, if we identify this with some phi of k comma t, remember though k here is discrete, okay, not continuous, but if we associate with it, if we associate this guy with this, then we see here that this quantity is the same, but now we've just translated it, that the k, the Gaussian, we've translated it over the angle states, okay, by an amount d divided by t, d divided by the period of the clock times t. And here again, we just acquire phase with the same amount. So you see here the analogy, right? It's straightforward. The only difference is that when we had a t, here we have a d divided by capital T times t, which is just the indication that this is an basically kind of like angular momentum versus linear momentum, okay? So here, like, it's periodic and you have like modular arithmetic, right? So here, when t equals capital T, you get k minus d, which is the same as the initial state, up to a phase. We integrate one times the phase, okay? So the proof outline is following. So first off, I'm going to give some intuitive intuition on how to prove, and then I'll show a little bit more details on some of the particular steps. I won't go into the full proof because it's very long and boring. So basically, the intuitive idea is the following. So remember that the initial state of the clock is just some Gaussian in the angle states, okay, basis. So at centered at k0. So then the idea is, what happens, how can we bound if we apply an evolution for a small amount of time delta of just the clock Hamiltonian? So remember that this was the clock Hamiltonian is in the Jaeger-Jagan basis, and these two bases are related by discrete Fourier transform, okay? So basically, if you want to calculate this, you can do a discrete Fourier transform. Then in that, but in the energy eigen basis, it corresponds to applying a phase. And then if you want to write it back in terms of the angle basis, you have to do an inverse discrete Fourier transform. Okay, so we call that process. We call this the resulting state psi prime. And then if to psi prime we want to apply just the clock potential for a small amount of time, then that's easy because this is in the same, it's diagonal in the same basis, right? This was diagonal on the clock basis, this is in the clock basis, so it just corresponds to a phase. So basically the proof works on calculating these things for some small amount delta. It calculates it and then it bounds an error, like an error term, in these two things. And then we can apply, and then the next step is to combine these together in such a way that we can apply the Lie product formula to get the actual dynamics of the actual quantum of interest, which is the Hamiltonian of both things together, okay? And when we apply this, this will give us the kind of exact solution plus on error term, okay? Which is the thing we can bound. So we can roughly see what's going on here if we look at the setup and like an infinite D limit, and like we say, the direct Fourier transform is approximately just, converges to the Fourier transform. So in this limit, this is just a rough guideline, so you see what's happening here. But if we say like, okay, in this limit of infinite dimension, like the k would be like a continuous. So we say x is just some continuous variable, and we remember the initial state was a Gaussian, okay? So it also had a phase, and people don't remember that, but I couldn't draw it here. But it also had a phase, so it was of this form, okay? So now if we apply if we look at the first step, the first thing we have to do is apply Fourier transform gives us this, then we want to apply a phase. So we apply a phase in a P space, and it just corresponds to adding this. And then we want to go back again to the original basis, which corresponds to inverse Fourier transform, which gives us this guy. And then remember the second step was applying this phase shift in the clock basis, so that just corresponds to adding this. So if we look, what's happened is that we've gone from this guy to this guy, for applying these two together, which is just basically what we've done is we've translated the position by an amount delta, and we've added a phase where this potential, that the phase depends on V, which depends on this angle, okay? So roughly speaking, we get something like this. And then, of course, we apply this many, many times, like M times together, and take the limits, and and we'll get that. So that's the rough idea. So the actual proof consists in a few lemmas put together, which basically mimic those first and second steps and the third step above. So I'll briefly just go through the basic idea. So the actual thing that's hard to prove is this first lemma. The others are relatively simple. This is like the core of the whole proof. So so basically it just tells you how, if you want to translate a small amount delta, the clock Hamiltonian, so this is just the initial state, well, when delta is zero at least, but yeah, we write it in this like more general form, that we get, again, we get the initial state, but the shifted amount, and we get some error epsilon, where the error epsilon in two norm is bounded by this quantity here, okay, which is linear in delta and has this exponential decay in D. So that's the quantity you saw in the main theorem, okay? So how do we go about proving this? Well, these are, I don't want to go through the whole proof very long, I just list the proof ingredients, so the essential ingredients we needed to get the results. So first things are Poisson summation formulas. This is my language, I'm not sure the technique called forward and backwards types, but I call them this. So basically, what these allow you to do is they're kind of like sampling formulas. So they tell you that if you have the function and you're sampling it with a weighted sum over some particular points, then that's equal to sampling its Fourier transform. Okay? So this allows you, because here we're sampling, in a sense, like sums of quantities we define continuous assertions of, it allows us to go from the function to its Fourier transform and backwards and forwards. Okay? So this is very important. And then, okay, we integrate and differentiate d times, so integrate by parts a number of times depending on the dimensionality. We use the generalized Lipschitz rule. We find a relationship between the result and the Rodriguez formulas for Hermite polynomials. And we use the orthogonality conditions of these Hermite polynomials. We use the Fardy-Primrose formula, which is a formula about the derivative of composition of functions. We find that this is all related to combinatorial factors, which are then related to Bell polynomials. From there, we write these in terms of Bell numbers. We get analytic bounds for the Bell numbers, how they behave in the large limit. Then we use Stirling's formula to bound them, factorials. And then we just use the fundamental theorem calculus to write things and, yeah, some other things. So that's kind of the basic proof overview. And we needed every one of these ingredients was really essential to get the answer. The next lemma is kind of stage two that I showed you in the overall thing. This is very easy to prove. Because everything is already in the right basis, we just apply a phase and then we show that the error is proportional to delta squared. So actually it turns out, and this is easy to prove with Taylor's reminder theorem. This error actually then, when we apply the lead product formula, turns out not to contribute. It's only that the first one actually has the error is non-vanishing. So like the third kind of really important ingredient is this thing, is this other lemma that's you can prove on the back of envelope. It's very simple, but basically what it tells you is that the errors add up simply. In the previous things, what we do is we bound, if we apply a small unitary on something, we can say, well, it's equal to what we want plus some error ket, if you want, and we bound that we manage to bound the norm of that particular error ket. So this is only useful if there's a relationship between when we apply then the lead product formula and the actual thing we want, we can actually use the bounds we got for the little simple things and just add up all those. So we have this nice property that we just have the sum of the local errors, if you want. So when we apply the Lie product formula, we just kind of a limit where we have m lots of these because all the same, and we take limits and blah, and we get a finite quantity out. So that was also very essential. It's very simple, but very, very essential, nice little trick we use. Yeah, the proof is easy by induction. And then there's two more technical lemmas I won't go into because the physical intuition is not so clear, but they're relatively simple to prove. So that's the kind of basic proof overview. Conclusion. So to the best of our knowledge, this is the first time anyone's actually managed to say any quantitative statements about these clocks. So about how their errors scale with time and critically with dimension. So it's not at all clear at first why it's, say, exponential decay versus something else, how the rate of decay depends on the potential. So things are kind of intuitive it should do, but you know how it does, et cetera, has not really been known. And then also it's nice that in our proof you can see the analogy between the linear momentum and this angular momentum and really that the two clocks are really, really behaving in the same way, in the sense that our clock is really just a sampling version, a sampled angular version of the linear infinite dimension one, but with the nice critical point that it's actually a physical clock, in the sense this is bounded from below, and it's a real clock that you could really, well, at least in principle, construct in a lab, right? Whereas the unbounded from the Hamiltonian below, you couldn't construct even in principle. So in terms of applications, well, one could look at the energy time uncertainty relations and there probably apply it directly and get some relation between time and energy. There's this alternative tick game proposed by Sandra, some other guy, you probably know his name? Yongxing and Renato. So this is basically the idea that if you have two clocks and Alice has one clock, Bob has another clock, and then there's a referee, and basically Alice and Bob have the objective that the referee gets clicks, if you want, from the clocks that alternate. So a click from Alice's clock, click from Bob's clock, click from Alice's clock, click from Bob's clock, et cetera, et cetera. And then as a measure of how good these clocks are, how well they can be synchronized, the referee will say the game's finished, it's kind of fouls, when he receives two consecutive ticks from, say, Bob or Alice, rather than Alice Bob, okay? And here, but the paper's kind of states a kind of general the setup, but here we could actually get some very quantitative kind of results by just applying directly our clocks and say how the time that the referee will say the game is valid for as a function of the dimension of these clocks, say, okay? And how good the potentials are, turning on and off. Other applications, well, I mean, essentially anywhere in quantum mechanics where you're going to apply some unitary from some microscopic system, you could ask, well, how actually can I do it with a clock, right? So kind of like that applies to many, many areas in physics, in quantum mechanics. And then, also in quantum thermodynamics. So here it's assumed, actually this is the part where we're working with Michal Horodesky on, actually. So the thing about these clocks, in quantum thermodynamics, it's assumed that for free, you're allowed to apply energy-preserving unitaries to your thermal bath and your system of interest, okay? So of course, in reality, you won't be able to do for this unitary perfectly, so it's nice to know how you can bound the error. And this is especially important in this context because of a concept known as embezzling. So what people have shown is that, so for example, even suppose there was a perfectly reasonable, perfectly physical quantum clock that was infinite dimensional, that turned on your unitary exactly at this time, and then for the rest of the time of the universe, it essentially didn't interrupt with the system, okay? Like did the perfect clock before, but it was actually physical. So it was actually, Hamilton bounded from below. Suppose such a clock existed, well, it'd still be very, very useless for the point of view of this question here. The reason being, useless, I mean, it's clear. It's not clear, let's say, the actual physical application because of this problem known as embezzling. So basically what people can show is that if you have two states, so state transformations, that are allowed under the set of thermal operations to a state A or to a state B, and if these two states A and B differ by just epsilon amount in trace distance, then in principle, for arbitrary small epsilon, for one, you could extract a lot of work, and for the other one, you could extract no work. So basically, the point, it depends not only on how close two things are in trace distance, but also how large their dimensionality is. So if you had something that's vanishing, that tends to zero in trace distance, but of infinite dimension, then in principle, you could embezzle lots of work from one another. So here, it's really important to know how the error scales with the unitary you can apply with its dimensionality. So the two things are, there's a critical relationship between the two to prove that in this context you can't embezzle work. And then hopefully there are many other applications. And hopefully there are other applications. So this result actually is not in the archive yet. We hope to put it up in the next week or so. But it'll be nice if some of you guys, you know, experts in quantum stuff could give any like ideas or whatever. Yeah, so I think that's more or less it. Yeah, question? Yeah. Yeah, so the referee, so in this game, the referee, I forget the exact details actually. I think he's here.
I mean, in your model of the clock,
I see.
How are you reading out the time?
So if you look back at the initial, so kind of our figure of merit here is, if you look at the, if we remember back, let's go back. I kind of said this at the beginning, but then probably at that point it wasn't clear why I was interested in it. Yeah, so basically we say that the objective is we compare our clock with the ideal case. And the ideal case we define like this. So we say, ideally, you want your system to be, you know, some local dynamics, and you'd apply this unitary. So we say after one period, they should be the same. Actually, to be honest, I want to work out a slightly more detailed version of this. Because this result here just tells you that after one period, so I'm assuming here that this T here is less than one period. So that the unitary is applied sometime, you know, within the one period of the clock, okay? But, so this only tells you, strictly speaking, that after one period of the clock, that essentially that the state of the ideal case where the unitary is applied is the same as if the clock applied it. But that doesn't tell you, of course, in between, right? So the idea is you want initially nothing to happen in the unitary, right? So it's true, as written, that doesn't tell you anything, but I'm quite sure it's straightforward from the clock result to get that, actually. It's just, yeah, if you go back a few steps in this quality, you can get something that should be the bound. But yeah, we'll do that in the next few days. And then for the clock, really, for the clock point of view, really what you're interested in knowing is that you have compared the case where the clock Hamiltonian is not coupled to anything, it just evolves naturally, because that is kind of like a perfect clock. And you compare that, and what we do here is we compare that to the case where we have back action from the system, right? Because as you remember, the case of Homer, when Homer wakes up the clock, he also breaks the clock because it annoys him. So this is back action effects, right? So we compare the ideal case of no back action with back action after one period. And again, the error, so our results imply, because these quantities, our result proves that they decay exponentially in the dimension. So basically what you have to do here is, where you have these guys, you just have to plug in. Oh, sorry. Wait, was this after? No, I've gone too far, haven't I? Where are we? Yeah, so you just have to plug in this guy here. So, of course, it's square root or some exponential decay, so it's exponential decay. Yeah. So that's it.
So, I guess you're right, you're saying that this unitary that is implemented could be one tick in particular. Could be like this system where I'm implementing something.
Yes. Yes, it could be one tick, and yeah, or you could, I suppose you could have the potential to have multiple interactions, and it just tick 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 at the one period. Yeah, I mean here there's no restriction by our theorem that this potential has to only have one point in it, right? It could have multiple points, and you'd still get the result.
If you were going to play the tick game,
yeah,
you'd have two clocks.
Oh yes, sorry, yeah. No, the idea is that the clocks don't interact. I think this is the case, to be honest. I haven't read it in full.
You need to have some measurement to know that they're ticking sequentially.
Yeah, so.
How would you imagine implementing that in this case, in your model?
So, in the paper, I have to read the full details of the paper, actually. But Ralph read the paper and was saying, yeah, this really applies very well. But so my understanding is the system, if you want, what was Homer in this case would be the referee, and these clocks, the clock system, one's called Clock, one called Alice, one's called Bob, And then he will receive, so there are two separate clocks, right? But they interact with the same system. So this system will at time one unitary coming from one system, one unitary from the other, and it's going to do some measurement. I think it's proposed as like a game. So Alice and Bob tell a strategy of measurements, I think it is, to the referee, who just has to implement them. And then Alice and Bob have to do the best, you know, say the best strategy or something like that. Yeah.
So you restricted at the start to these unitaries being energy preserving.
Yes.
Say much about why.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Why? Well, we're so I suppose. Yeah, the idea is that we're just interested in a setup where the system where you apply some energy preserving unitaries, so you're not giving it energy or not. I haven't really thought how you might generalize this to the case of non-energy preserving case, but maybe it's also can work. Yeah, but yeah, so it applies to the energy preserving case. It's true.
I also didn't get why you started with a Gaussian rather than just like a single.
Oh, why? Well, intuitively, we think it's probably better for like, in the sense you have smaller error. Our theorem, if it was strictly a Dirac delta, right? So you would the derivatives would have to be infinitely steep. So if you want, as you made it steeper and steeper and steeper, the decay would be worse and worse and worse. So yeah, I think it really there's a trade-off between how steep your potential is and how the error is in the clocks. You can't for free make it really steep, because that just gives a more of a jolt back on the clock, like a bigger reaction. It's a bit like going up, if you have a nice smooth slope, you can go up and down rather than going up, like hitting a wall and trying to go up and down the wall. Oh, okay, maybe it's not a very good analogy, but I think it kind of is like this. Yeah, of course, ideally from the point of view of like a perfect clock, you want it to be as steep as possible, but then there's a trade-off between how, you know, how good the unitary is implemented from the point of view of the system, how small the back action is on the clock, and how large the dimensionality of the clock is, right? These three things are all interrelated.
Okay, so let's meet you again.